Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll start today with our week in review, starting with a new governor for Massachusetts.
And I fully expect it's going to be a very smooth and productive transition as well, and I'm looking forward to getting started.
With a Republican in the corner office and GOP gains in the legislature, the incoming House Speaker says cooperation between the two parties is the only way forward.
I think that's what the public expects. They don't want to see in Massachusetts what's happening in Washington.
Also, despite a national Republican wave, voters in increasingly blue New Hampshire said no thanks to Scott Brown.
I accept the decision of the voters, and I have already offered my sincerest congratulations and good wishes to Senator Shaheen.
So where does Scott Brown go next? Joining me now to talk about these stories and the rest of the week's news is Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, good to have you in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. And Jim, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Good to be with you.
So let's kick off with a look at the governor's race. The suspense went into the wee hours of Wednesday morning, but in the end, it was governor-elect Charlie Baker.
Thank you very much to the voters of Massachusetts for giving Karen and me this opportunity to serve as your governor and lieutenant governor. Certainly for me, it is the honor of a lifetime and something that I will cherish every single day.
Honor of a lifetime, and I guess he's had his eye on this office for something like 30 years. But Jim, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on the election results this week? What did Baker do so right?
I think Charlie Baker came across as somebody who's deeply caring about Massachusetts. I mean, I think one of the things that impresses me about Charlie is he really wants to be governor of Massachusetts. I don't think he's actually using this, as you've seen so many times before, to run for some sort of national office. This is sort of the dream come true for him. I think that does come across. I actually think on the other side, look, it was an incredibly close election. 40,000 votes separated the two of them on a base of about 2.1 million votes. Coakley ran a good campaign. She was energetic, nothing like the stereotypes that had come out of the 2010 run where she wouldn't shake hands at Fenway Park because it was too cold. That was not the race that she ran. I think she had an extremely tough race to run. If you are running where your predecessors of the same party, it's a bit like a relay race in the sense that he's going to pass you the baton, but every time she's running around doing laps, he's dropping the baton, whether it's the Department of Children and Families, whether it is unemployment insurance, the health care connector, 500 managers who were made into union employees 2 weeks before the election, Olga Rochet being held over so she could get a pension, that announced 2 weeks before the election. That's really hard to run that race.
Yeah, right. Scott, how about you? It's been noted that Charlie Baker ran on positions that in other states would make him a liberal Democrat. How do you think he'll govern? Do you think he'll govern as a liberal Democrat?
I know. I think he will do well. I think he'll govern as a moderate Republican, fiscal conservative, social, libertarian, liberal. I think he's a smart guy with a reasonably good sense of people, and I think you'll find someone in the Speaker who wants to work with him. Stan Rosenberg in the Senate, I think, probably will too. He watched Weld, and Weld was very adept at personal relationships, finding one legislative ally and sort of making the other one the odd man out. And I think that Baker will be able to do that as well. I think he has not quite Weld's interpersonal skills because he does have a bit of a temper, and he can get mad, although he doesn't hold a grudge. I've had a couple, I wouldn't say blowouts, but loud voiced, almost yelling matches with him. He puts it aside and moves on. So I do think that he will be able to focus. I think he'll be able to compromise. I think he understands the issues. And I think having a Republican there for a lot of the liberal Dems will, particularly for the Senate president, he will have to say, guys, look, the governor was elected. He wants to do this. We have to move toward the middle on this. Whereas when you had a Democratic governor who didn't really want to move that much toward the middle, there was no incentive. So I think actually we'll see some quite good bipartisan governance here.
Yeah. Scott, I was really intrigued by your piece this week. My prediction, things will go reasonably well here in Massachusetts, but miserably in Washington, talking about divided governments. Yeah. What do you think of that, Jim?
Well, I think here in Massachusetts, it will go quite well. I think Mark Robinson had a little piece in the Globe today, advice for the governors, and Mark Robinson has been very close to Charlie Baker for quite some time, and he talked about building a broad coalition. I think the differential I was referring to, the 40,000 vote differential, indicates where Baker will need to go if he wants to govern the state and get stuff done. I do think with DeLeo, he will have a strong relationship. Remember, he won Winthrop, which is DeLeo's district, 54 to 42, I believe. That's not something that's going to be lost on the speaker. The speaker's already, I think, somewhat aligned with the kind of reforms that Baker would like to do. The big question, as Scott said, is the relationship with Stan Rosenberg, the new Senate president. And I think there are some indications that might go quite well as well, given the fact that Charlie is quite liberal socially, which does matter to the new Senate president.
So I want to ask you both just a little bit about the soon-to-be Governor Baker's agenda when he takes office. He gave an interesting interview to the Globe in the paper this morning talking about his intention to deal with the state's ongoing opiate crisis in the first 6 months. Scott, what do you think about that as a sort of first order of business?
Well, that really interested me because when he was a state senator, Steve Tolman, president of the AFL-CIO, was huge on that issue. He cared so much about that, and he would come in the bureau, you guys have got to realize there's this major thing. So I look at that in a way, I mean, I think it is a very serious issue. I think Steve was ahead of his time in recognizing it. A lot of people would say, what is Tolman ranting about? But he really had something there. And this is Baker reaching out on that and saying, this is where I can work with a guy who was really, in some way, a centerpiece of the opposition and address an issue that we both agree is big. Now, I think that for the governor, for Stan Rosenberg, probably for Tolman as well, an early victory, something that says, look, well, this shows we can work together, an accomplishment, very important. And I think he's found an issue that is something that everyone believes is an issue. I didn't see it coming. I was a little surprised by that, but I think it's smart politics.
Interesting. Jim?
I completely agree with that. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of making a demonstration of wanting to work across the aisle on some really hard issues. I think criminal justice may be one that may be in the offing as well. I think, of course, he's going to try and bring his managerial skills to bear on the number of scandals and mismanagements that we've seen over the past few years. I think the overarching agenda truly is what he campaigned on. And I'd say one thing that does excite me is this. Folks who have been center-right to some degree in terms of management of the government have very infrequently taken an interest in the plight and the future of our cities. Rudy Giuliani in the 1990s, with the help of, say, Manhattan Institute, did some of this work. But if you look across the country at Republican governors, really there's no one who's taken on in a holistic way. And I think one of the things I keep hearing, given his interest in campaigning in cities, is I'm going to make a point of that, whether it's education, public safety, a strategy for working with mayors to actually get jobs back downtown. That could be exciting if it comes to fruition. I think, frankly, to build the kind of coalition he wants to build, the city representatives and senators are going to be huge.
Well, interesting, as you say, that he did spend an awful lot of time during the campaign in cities, in Boston in particular. I want to talk a little bit about the kind of person he might bring into the administration. Here's what he had to say after meeting with Governor Deval Patrick earlier this week.
Well, I think the most important thing you need to do is start off with a process and a set of key players in place who can sort of drive that on behalf of both the current administration and the incoming one, and we had a great conversation about that and how that's going to work, and I think that, I frankly think that's going to go quite well. I'm not worried about it at all.
So getting a set of key players in place. Scott, your thoughts on Baker's first moves in this regard?
Well, he needs to find his own Charlie Baker, a couple of his own Charlie Bakers, some very bright people that you can put in.
Baker.
Yeah, and get to do things. And I will say, you can argue in a way that the Republican bench is a little narrow, a little thin. But I think that he will be willing to reach out and probably put some Democrats he thinks would agree with him in. I don't see him. I think he, as Jim said, he leans center right, but I don't see him as a hyper partisan or as a hardcore ideologue. I see him more as a pragmatist who believes in the values of competition, I think, in government. I think he has a reasonable theory of it's hard to change. I mean, it is really hard to change state government. And I think he has a reasonable theory of how you go about doing that. You start here and you sort of push the change and show it can work and then leverage it and that kind of thing. So I think it will be quite an interesting era to govern. This last term of Governor Patrick's, I think, has been really quite a disappointment. And I think we're going to see new energy, new focus, and new approaches. And I think, frankly, that's overdue.
Jim, Scott mentioned, maybe he brings in some high-profile Democrats into his cabinet. Do you expect a move like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I look at Scott was talking just a minute ago about the Weld model. Mm. And I think that is precisely the blueprint that Baker will work from. It is really important for him to reach out and build that set of coalitions to get the work done that he wants to do. Look, he made his career early on in state government in Health and Human Services with a real focus on human services. That is not an area that generally is one that Republican governors spend a lot of time on. They'll do things like big health care reform, or they'll do big reforms, usually thinking about dollars and cents. That's one that he feels closely. I think the opiate issue that he's raising is trying to signal to people, I want to work across the aisle, and I think he will.
I want to move on and talk about Scott Brown in just a second, but I just want to ask you guys about one more thing here in Massachusetts. The legislature, of course, remains dominated by Democrats. Even though the GOP did make gains in both houses on Tuesday, there'll be six Republicans in a 40-member Senate, and of the 160 members of the House of Representatives, 35 will be Republicans. So Democrats still dominant, but what does that pickup mean? I mean, Scott, on the one hand, you can say the GOP doubled their numbers in the Senate.
That's a very optimistic sort of toothpaste commercial spin on it. Oh, you know, honestly, the Republicans in the Senate are not. The Senate works in a collegial way, and I will say, I think different Senate leaders have been able to get a lot. Republican leaders have been able to get a lot done, not because they stand up and make on their hind legs and yell and scream, but because they have some pretty good ideas, and I think that's true of Bruce Tarr. I think people really like him there. He's a good Republican leader. He's witty. He makes an argument. He doesn't personalize it. And I think he had a lot of input, and people would pick up his ideas because he did want to work together. Just as a matter of numbers. I mean, you got to make your case on collegiality in the issues. As a matter of numbers, they're really not much of a factor.
Yeah. Jim, do you agree?
Oh, I do agree. I think, look, you've got a couple Senate seats that were picked up. There's still no veto. You can't uphold the veto.
Right.
And that's the key number. You have to get to 14 to actually have it stick and make a difference. The question I'd have is on the House side. The pickup of six new seats, what does it mean for the party leadership? Does Brad Jones remain? There have been a lot of infighting in the party, small party. But the addition of six people, where will their allegiances lie?
So let's move on to Scott Brown. So big Republican wave across the nation, of course. It didn't wash over New Hampshire. Incumbent Jean Shaheen held on to her seat. Scott Brown went down. Here's what Andy Smith, pollster of the UNH at University of New Hampshire, had to say about the Scott Brown-Jean Shaheen race.
If he had been a local guy, he would have been in a much better position than if he had been just recently from out of state.
Yeah.
But that said, that really shows the strength of this Republican wave across the country. And the fact that Shaheen was able to weather it here really, I think, points to her skills as a politician and her years in public service here.
So, Scott Lehigh, what did you take away from that race in New Hampshire?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I have to say, I'm not that impressed with Scott Brown. I never have been. He's a good campaigner, but I think his bandwidth is quite narrow. He went up and ran what, honestly, I thought was kind of an intellectually stupid race, just generic things. I went up and watched a speech he gave up there. At St. A's, and it was just god awful, just so contrived. It purported to be about foreign policy, and it was so contrived and so expedient. And he wouldn't even take any questions afterwards. Here you are at a college giving a talk at a college with an audience of students, and at least some students. And he hustled right out like the scared chipmunk routine he always does. And I wasn't surprised at all. I was a little surprised it was that close, but I wasn't at all surprised that she beat him. Honestly,
so when I look at this race, Jim, I sort of see. I don't know. I have trouble with two narratives. On the one hand, with respect to Scott, on the other hand, Brown jumped in really late. He went up against a popular Democrat and came within 2 points. On the other hand, Jean Shaheen, as we said, withstood this Republican wave, which speaks well of her. I don't know if those two narratives are in conflict with each other, but they're sort of part of the story.
I actually don't think they're in conflict at all. I think you make a great point in what Scott was saying just a second ago about being, he's a disciplined campaigner.
Yeah.
I like math. I found it almost mathematically improbable the number of times you could actually say, Senator Shaheen has agreed with the president 99% of the time. It just, at some point, there was no
Scott's
room for other words.
Pained. He's looking pained.
but I think here's a couple of weeks ago, you guys were kind and had me on, and we're talking about the New Hampshire race, and I was saying, I always have the feeling that New Hampshire follows the national trends, and New Hampshire did not.
Yeah.
Governor Hassan, Annie Custer, Congresswoman, was reelected, and Jean Shaheen was reelected. So New Hampshire marches to the beat of its own drummer.
Yeah, it marches to the beat of its own drummer. And Scott, one of the points that Andy Smith made to us, the pollster up there at UNH, is that this state is increasingly blue. It is increasing. I mean, of course, the largest share of voters are unenrolled, but it is becoming more Democratic as time goes on.
Yeah, it's a little different from here where the unenrolled voters have Democratic default values because they used to be Democrats. Up there, they didn't used to be Democrats, but they were independents and Republicans, and they seem like now they have adopted Democratic default values. So they tend to, I mean, you know, all other things being equal, they seem to kind of like the Democratic candidate, and it's you know, it's a very interesting development, certainly.
Well, what I heard up there on election night, the best sort of comment I heard at Jean Shaheen headquarters was that Scott Brown ran against Obama. Jean Shaheen ran on a record, and she really did. I mean, it has to be said that Scott Brown went to a lot of local events. He campaigned really hard. He drove his truck all over the place. But Jean Shaheen, I think it was David Scharfenberg that put it this way, you know, she ran like mayor of New Hampshire. And I think that works in New Hampshire. And at the end of the day, talking about ISIS and Ebola, I'm sure it frightened a lot of people, but I don't think it impressed New Hampshire voters.
Can I give
in
an example of Scott Brown, though?
When I was
up there watching, now that we're talking, this was when we were talking about action, what was going to be done against the Islamic State. Natural question is there, do you go to Congress? Should the Congress have a role in authorizing that? After his big foreign policy speech, knowing that people, I asked him that question on the way out. Do you think Congress should have to authorize that? Just walked right by. You talked to his people. Oh, we don't know where he is on that. We don't know what his position. How can you not know what his position is? Across town, Jean Shaheen's doing an event. You go over. I got there a little late. She was taking questions from the press. You could ask her anything you wanted. And later on, they said, hey, she'll take more questions if you didn't get your question in. I mean, a huge difference in terms of availability, accessibility to the press. And I think that really tells in a way.
I do think that two losses straight probably ends his career.
My next question is, what happens to Scott Brown?
And I think that the same thing is probably true of the Attorney General.
Mm. Well, let's come back to the Attorney General, because I actually wanted to spend, I didn't mean to jump over that part of the story. Martha Coakley, of course, campaigned hard. You know, she had that terrible drubbing in 2010 to Scott Brown. But what do you make of her loss? And I want to play some tape. Here she is conceding. Let's listen to her.
All right. So this is where I might need my Kleenex. Really. I want to say this to all the young women who have worked on this campaign, who have thought about running for office, who have tried and maybe not won. It's important that you do it.
That's right.
It's important that you lean in.
And so there's an emotional Martha Coakley. That was Wednesday morning. Scott Lehigh, how do you sort of assess where she goes from here?
Well, I think she probably honestly goes to a law firm really now, or maybe she does some public service nonprofit. But I think she's a decent person, and we have a tendency to trash people who lose, and I've just trashed Scott Brown. I don't want to trash her, but I will say this. I still don't really know what she was running on. I don't think she had a very coherent agenda beyond just kind of, I'm the generic Democrat, and it was kind of like running for Governor Patrick's third term, and as I say, I don't think that's a hugely appetizing prospect for a lot of people. She was so involved with not letting there be any big differences with her opponents in the primary that she didn't take any really hard positions. And after that, it was almost too late, but really hard to get a good sense of things that she was committed to and had thought about that were different. And I think people they just said, huh, what is this really? And Baker, his stuff might have been a little small bore and boring in terms of making state government work better, but I think people got that.
Yeah, it was a message you could have repeated.
Much more sense of purpose.
Right.
And I do think ultimately that's her big problem. I as I say, I think she's a fine person. I got really to kind of enjoy her sense of humor, sort of sly wit this campaign, but I don't think they did a very good job running the campaign.
Yeah. Jim?
My take is probably a little bit different. I'm just thinking about the day that I went to vote. There were no poll watchers out. 2006, 2008, 2010, 2012. the Mass Democratic Party had poll watchers out. If they were, you were a likely Democratic voter and you hadn't actually checked in and voted, they'd go out and contact you. I think the party, after all that intensive work that John Walsh did with Governor Patrick, was fatigued. After a while, you can't keep up that pace. And the second thing is, I guess I'd say this. This is maybe not the nicest thing to say about the current chairman of the Democratic Party, but John Walsh was an amazing motivator and organizer, and he had at his disposal one of the great campaigners of our generation, Governor Patrick. I don't know that Tom McGee has that kind of ability to drive the party's energy level. I just didn't see it out there.
All right. Well, let's move on. We've got just enough time for our hubbubs, those stories that sort of fell below the fold this week. Scott Lehigh, what's your hubbub?
Mine is the Year of the Woman, which took place in 1996, I think, nationally, finally arrived in Massachusetts. Four of our six constitutional office holders are now women. And of course, we have now a female U.S. senator and two members of our congressional delegation. So we're making a little progress there.
So I'm going to just to make sure our listeners know, Karen Polito, Lieutenant Governor, Democrat Maura Healey, the new Attorney General, Democrat Deb Goldberg, the State Treasurer, and Democrat Suzanne Bump, one re-election of State Auditor.
Yeah.
Right. So Year of the Woman. Jim, your hubbub.
As a card-carrying Rhode Islander once upon a time, I turned to the race down the governor's race there, which featured a Democrat, Gina Raimondo, who's opposed by public employee unions, and a Republican, Alan Fung, who's backed by them. Raimondo won. That's an odd occurrence in and of itself. Odder still was the fact that Robert Healey of the Cool Moose Party, who sports a beard every bit as impressive as late period Karl Marx, and who garnered a stunning 22% of the vote, 68,000 votes, spent a whopping $35.31. That's 1/20 of a penny per vote. Jeff McCormick should have studied his campaign. He spent over $1 million for about 16,000 votes. That's about $70 to $80 a vote.
All right, that's a great hubbub. And so this one follows really well. And I want to go back to Scott Brown and Gene Shaheen. I think there was something like $36 million in outside spending on that race. New Hampshire has about 1 million people, about 450,000 of them can vote. 450,000 of them can vote. So that comes to $82 per voter. So I've raised you a little bit there, Jim. But someone in New Hampshire said to me on election night, you know, gee, they could have just mailed everyone a check for $80, and we would have ended up the same way. Gene Shaheen, Senator. Scott Brown, not Senator. Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks for coming in.
It's good to be with you.
And Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Thank you, Scott.
Thank
you. Have a
great
weekend. Stay with us. We'll speak with independent gubernatorial candidate Evan Falchuk, who cleared a key hurdle Tuesday night to create a new independent party in Massachusetts. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.